Oh, shame.
And I'm Dynamite, the hypest man in the business.
And if you got ears, listen to 90.3 CKUT.
UT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding at ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Let's
الأيام ويساعدني وحنانه يروي شوقي وحبيبي على فين يا موج الشوق موديني بحلم بدنيا يحبها ناسها وتحب ناسها تشيلها فوق راسها في أنفاسها والعيد لا تيدي أغرصها بحلم أطير وأثبت جناحاني على فين يا موج
spoke to Mira Shaw from Palestine Legal about their new website tracking anti-BDS legislation around the country.
I wanted to talk about this new website that Palestine Legal just launched to track anti-BDS laws across the country. Can you talk about what motivated the organization to want to put that all in one place and how people navigating the site will potentially use it?
Yeah, so Palestine Legal has been tracking this legislation targeting advocacy for Palestinian rights since 2014. We've seen the spread of these bills and laws, 200 introduced at the state and federal level over the past 6 years, 30 states with anti-boycott laws in effect, over around 70 non-binding resolutions that express the official view of lawmakers condemning boycotts for Palestinian rights. You know, so this is a spread of legislation and an effort to really silence the movement for Palestinian rights in this country. We wanted to sort of document these efforts and their evolution over time. The site provides, you know, information by state and at the federal level and kind of documents the kinds of bills that we've been seeing, the very similar language that you see across these bills. But it also provides resources and statistics and analysis that hopefully helps to understand and to fight back against these efforts to silence advocacy, to better understand where these bills are coming from, who's been pushing them, but also how it connects to sort of the broader effort to silence dissent in this country, and the kind of anti-protest legislation and the sort of legislative efforts to crush dissent that we're seeing across our social movements.
Last week, we saw Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He spoke about BDS attack, the movement, equated it with anti-Semitism. Can you maybe speak to what kind of impact the Trump administration has had on these BDS laws that the organization covers?
You know, I think it's really clear that the Trump administration has waged a sort of full-on assault on Palestinians and those who advocate for freedom and justice for Palestinians since day one. You can see it in the foreign policy realm with the embassy move, you know, cuts to UNRWA funding, sort of long ongoing attempts to legitimize Israel's illegal settlements. You saw in the executive order last December that adopted this distorted definition of anti-Semitism that was meant to stifle criticism of Israel. And, you know, now in the administration's last days, kind of seems like they're trying to double down on these efforts. And I think Pompeo's actions last week really expose this effort for what it is. And, you know, it's a sort of a right-wing, very racist smear campaign that is targeting protected expression and support for Palestinian rights. So I think that what it does, I think, is hopefully make it really clear what these efforts are about. It's not about, you know, actually fighting real and dangerous and rising anti-Semitism that the Trump administration has actually stoked over the years. And it really is an effort to stifle, you know, protected advocacy and to sort of silence criticism of Israel. And so, you know, I think what Pompeo's moves, you know, should do is really clarify for lawmakers and, you know, the incoming administration, hopefully, that this is an attack that needs to be rejected, and that in order to really stand up for sort of, you know, free expression, constitutional rights, and the principles of freedom and justice for all, that these efforts to sort of redefine anti-Semitism in these ways and to really, you know, adopt this twisted and distorted definition, but also the efforts to sort of smear a movement for freedom and justice need to be rejected. And, you know, I think that hopefully that's what the message is that's coming through.
When you go on the website, some of the states that have passed anti-BDS laws are states that don't really have any business relationship with Israel, which is a little curious. I'm wondering if you could speak to maybe where the impetus for these kind of laws comes from, who's pushing it. And a lot of the work that the organization does also focuses on these lawsuits, which get filed against groups like SJP on campuses. I'm wondering if the forces that kind of push that type of stifling of dissent and the ones pushing these BDS laws at the state level overlap. Can you speak to kind of who the big players are when it comes to pushing this kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think to take some of those questions, you know, I think there's been some great investigative reporting looking into sort of, you know, what are the groups that are advocating for these laws? Who are the you know, lawmakers that are targeted to sort of push this legislation? And, you know, you see the right-wing racist Bill Mill Alec, which has, you know, promoted stand your ground laws, voter ID laws, you know, very problematic legislation, to say the least, also being, you know, one of the advocates for anti-boycott legislation and more recently, these anti-Semitism redefinition efforts as well. So, you know, you can kind of see definitely sort of this right-wing effort to crush dissent sort of across a range of different justice movements here in the U.S., Palestinian rights advocacy being one of them, but those engaged in pipeline protest work and, you know, standing up for indigenous rights and water rights, you know, the sort of racial justice movements, we've been seeing all the anti-protest legislation that's targeting those efforts as well. So, you know, it's of a piece. And, you know, I think it's important to situate it in that context. But I think that you also, you know, can look to these bills and sort of point out a couple of different other things besides the involvement of these right-wing groups. But in Missouri, for example, you know, I think it's a really interesting one. You know, it kind of highlights that, you know, it's not necessarily constituents that are pushing for or advocating for these bills, or certainly not, you know, perhaps the top of the priority list for constituents. This is in July of this past year. You know, it's at the height of a global pandemic. It's in the midst of the uprising for racial justice. And the Missouri Governor Mike Parsons signed an anti-boycott bill into law this past July, you know, so efforts by like from national and sort of state level groups had helped defeat similar bills in previous years. But, you know, during in the midst of this pandemic, you know, when it was hard for people to get out and sort of protest and these efforts, you know, we saw the governor signing this bill into law. Similarly, I think, you know, efforts like we've seen laws in bills in New York that have also sort of failed to pass the legislature, often because, you know, groups have pointed out the constitutional flaws in some of these bills. And in turn, you know, we've seen governors kind of take unilateral action. You saw this in Maryland and in New York, where governors signed executive orders after legislation failed to pass. So, you know, I think in terms of where these things are coming from and where the pushback is, those are all important to keep in mind, where pushback can be really effective. I think the last thing I'll say, you know, is an important one, is that, you know, Israel has claimed credit for these laws as well. You know, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs has warmly welcomed this type of legislation, has said that they've encouraged it. They're clearly interested in pushing for this kind of legislation that, you know, attempts to punish and criminalize criticism of its policies and advocacy for Palestinian rights here in the U.S.
Final question. Today, Olivia Catby Smith, who's a BDS activist, was suspended from Twitter after she was targeted by an anonymous pro-Israel group that, or Twitter account that smears pro-Palestine activists as anti-Semites. I'm just thinking of that in the context of some of the other headline stories we've seen in recent months, with Facebook considering the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which you mentioned. We saw Zoom shut down a pro-Palestine webinar. Palestine Legal has also worked on these issues. Can you maybe speak to how these corporations, big tech, which controls a lot of the information that we process and share with each other, how this issue of stifling dissent and censorship of Palestinian issues connects to them?
So I can't speak to that specific incident necessarily, but I do think, you know, it is connected to some of these bigger questions around Palestinian rights advocacy and the role of big tech. And as you said, you know, the both in terms of these efforts to redefine anti-Semitism in order to stifle criticism of Israel on these platforms. You know, I think that that is what pro-Israel advocates are trying to do, is to sort of lobby to have Facebook impose this definition so that content that's critical of Israel would not have a place on that platform, would be taken down. You know, and I think that that is a really dangerous precedent. And I think that it's something that all of us who sort of care about free speech, but also, you know, this, these principles of dissent and protest, it's absolutely critical that we need to push these big companies that, you know, have such an important role in providing platforms for communication. And, you know, especially when you talk about in the Zoom context, where we see universities using that platform for online classrooms, you know, where there's a, you know, a sort of academic freedom principles, First Amendment freedom principles, constitutional obligations for public universities, at least, you know, I think that there are some really big questions there about what are Zoom's obligations as a platform in the context of teaching. The broader conversation is, you know, how to really push these large social media companies to understand the important role that they, you know, need to play in ensuring that the content that they are allowing people to sort of engage in is as broad as possible, that, you know, we're able to hear Palestinian voices and that they're not stifled in this way using sort of really problematic definitions and terms to stifle dissent and sort of protected expression in that way.
Thanks so much for chatting with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to our podcast, a production of MondoWeiss.net.
First they hit with phase one, airstrikes all day and all night. Phase two, rockets hit the Gaza Strip with phosphorus. Phase three, ground attack, how we gonna counteract? Boycott, divest, and sanction. Boycott, divest, and sanction. Boycott, divest, and sanction. Israel, you should...
should be ashamed. Killing maimed thousands of civilians in our name. Claim you hitting terrorists, but children in your aim. Even murder relief workers, what's spilling from their brain? While they tried to drive the ambulance, so they couldn't stand a chance. Even bomb students, hospitals, Miles Rafa and Khan Yunus. Shot them in their back like the cops to Oscar Grant. And in each case, the good old United States sponsored that. $7 million a day that we pay tax and APAC's lobbyists is robbing us. Sometimes it feels like there ain't no stopping this. But now nobody can deny it, cause you made it too obvious. Naked truth exposed like the emperor's clothes. The struggle's getting hotter and the temperature rose. Since 1948, when you formed the state, Palestinian people still defending their homes. They ain't been surrendering, no. Boycott, divest, the sanction. Boycott, divest, the sanction. Boycott, divest, the sanction. Cause they even bombed the United Nations. Look, I'm Israeli, my government's so arrogant. War criminals who call Palestinians terrorists for resisting extinction and occupation, comparing this to genocide and reservations of Native Americans. It's a massacre, kick out the ambassador. Divest from the apartheid like South Africa. Boycott them like King to Montgomery buses. Show them we want peace, but only with real justice. Be murdering the media and witnesses left. We're gonna stop shopping at all the businesses that invest in building their settlements and gentrifying our corners. Illegal walls over there and the U.S.-Mexico border. Build a worldwide movement till the truth is heard. And supporting the Israelis who refuse to serve. All the COs who ate wall when deployed to Iraqi stations. All the people rallying while the cops are chasing. If we enlisted in the system, we got an obligation. And we ain't got the patience, time to stop the occupation. Yeah, boycott, divest, and sanction. Boycott, divest, and sanction. Boycott, divest, and sanction. Till there's right of return for displaced and reparations.
Boycott, divest, and sanction. Sir,
boycott, divest, and sanction.
Sir,
boycott, divest, and sanction.
There's a war criminal in this building.
We knew going in that the Biden-Harris administration would be no friend to Palestine. But they are, you know, they are a target. They are a target that can be moved in a way that Trump could not be moved.
I'm Henriya Chakar here with fellow 972 editor Natasha Roth-Roland. Hi, Natasha.
Hey, Henriya.
Natasha, you spoke with Sandra Tamari. She's the director of Adala Justice Project, a young Palestine advocacy organization based in the United States.
Yep, that's right. AJP has been organizing for several years now at both the grassroots and congressional levels to advocate for justice, freedom, and equality for Palestinians. But a lot of their work also centers around collective liberation and the kinds of relationships Palestinian activists can forge with other oppressed groups around the world.
You interviewed Sandra while U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was visiting Israel-Palestine back in November. After a nail-biting election in the United States, Trump was voted out and Joe Biden will be the next president. But the Trump administration seems to be launching as many anti-Palestine initiatives as it can while still in power.
Yeah, the conversation with Sandra reflected where I think a lot of progressive activists are right now. They're beyond relieved that the breakneck destruction of the Trump era has come to an end, or is about to come to an end. But at the same time, they're very clear-eyed about the scale of the work that remains, and that's everything from just surveying the wreckage and trying to undo some of the sheer devastation of the last 4 years, to the very real challenges of organizing under a Biden-Harris administration that, as Sandra says, is no friend to Palestine. So I'd say there's a sense of grounded hope in this political moment.
What were some of those challenges that Sandra pointed to?
I know this might sound counterintuitive at first. Coming back to a supposedly more bipartisan approach to Israel-Palestine doesn't necessarily move the needle in the right direction in terms of trying to achieve justice for Palestinians. As Sandra pointed out, there's been palpable relief among liberals and centrists that the new administration will bring with it a return to the idea of a peace process. But as Sandra says, that peace process ideal is a facade that actually complicates the struggle for justice. she says that as long as Trump was in power, there was more clarity about where Palestine stood in terms of the global rise in authoritarianism he represented versus the broad movement seeking to resist it.
Right. But what about some of the positives Sandra mentioned? What can people in the Palestine movement draw optimism from right now?
I mean, there are definitely upsides to this political shift. As Sandra said, the new generation of Palestinians is standing taller than ever before, and that's important when we're seeing such drastic polarization on Palestine. And even though the Biden-Harris administration is not where it needs to be on justice for Palestine, it's all the same, in Sandra's words, a target that can be moved. The chaos and extreme ideology of the Trump administration made it almost impossible to be strategic about which policies and individuals to try and push left. That's no longer the case. And what's more, as Sandra said, it's very clear where the work needs to be done and why Palestine doesn't just belong on the progressive agenda, but is in fact a core part of it. Sandra emphasizes that the key avenue for pressuring Israel is to disrupt the US's military funding, and we've seen some movement in that direction over the past couple of years. And when, as she says, that money comes home, it becomes available for all those other things that we're fighting for, whether that's healthcare, a decent minimum wage, student debt relief, a Green New Deal, and so on.
All right, let's get to it then.
Sandra Tamari of Adala Justice Project, thank you so much for coming on the 972 podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Natasha. It's really an honor to be here.
We're speaking just a few days after U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's trip to Israel-Palestine, in which he made a couple of hyper-partisan moves. Firstly, he made an unprecedented official visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. And secondly, he announced that the U.S. considers the BDS movement anti-Semitic and would begin withdrawing funds from organizations that boycott Israel. What, to your mind, is the immediate as well as the longer-term impact of that declaration on the Palestine movement in the United States?
Well, I think I'll start with the declaration of BDS as an anti-Semitic movement and move to the harder issues. I think, you know, it's not new, right, for Palestinian advocacy, Palestinian resistance to their oppression to be criminalized, delegitimized. I mean, we can, you know, go back to the beginning of Palestinian resistance. It's always, you know, been undermined by U.S. policy. It wasn't until 1993 that the PLO was considered a partner. You know, Fatah was a terrorist organization prior to that. And it's only through complete surrender and capitulation to U.S. terms that Palestinians are seen as partners. And so I don't worry too much about the attacks on BDS. I would worry about capitulation, which Palestinians are not, you know, going to do. The grassroots movement is strong. Palestinians, I think the new generation of Palestinians is more fearless and unapologetic than ever before. And so that part of it, you know, sure, they're going to keep trying to, you know, smear us in this way. But our movement is growing. And if you look at any polling about, you know, at least Democratic voters in this country, we can see that positions about Israel are changing radically. And so, you know, Pompeo wants to shoot, you know, more arrows at us. You know, that's fine. We're building stronger armor against that. The issue of settlements is really interesting because, you know, always the centrist position on Palestine has been two states, right? It's been, you know, the bipartisan sort of agreement in the U.S. And obviously annexation and continued settlement building, it goes directly against that. But I don't, you know, so right, Trump is going to, you know, has, you know, done everything he can to give Israel whatever they want. These, you know, Pompeo last moment gifts to Israel, you know, obviously they're very harmful, but I think the more dangerous thing we're facing is that I don't see that any of that will be challenged in the next administration. The Biden administration has made it very clear that, you know, they won't be, you know, pursuing any conditions on funding to Israel, which is the only, you know, the only tool that we have to exert any kind of pressure on Israel. So, you know, that's the thing I think that is most concerning to me we will get to a space where the centrists who are relieved that the Trump era is over will fall into this, you know, sleepiness. And the peace process, again, the facade of a peace process will take over. So, yeah, I do think that's very dangerous. And, you know, I don't know exactly what our answers will be, except that we will continue to resist those policies.
Well, I think that that sort of leads very nicely into the next question, which is kind of looking backward and looking forward. I mean, Pompeo's maneuvering is coming as the clock is running down on the Trump administration. But it sounds like there is this kind of mixed reaction to the fact that this new Biden administration, even though it's seeming to have kind of put the brakes on some of the most extreme maneuvering that's been happening at the U.S. government level, isn't necessarily going to return us to or you know, sort of move us forward into a more advantageous position vis-a-vis the Palestine movement. So, you know, when you heard that Biden had won and Trump had lost, how did you react as an individual on a personal level? And how did you react as an organizer in the Palestine movement, in as much as you can separate those two things?
Obviously, you know, the defeat of Trump on a personal level is a very welcome development. I can't even imagine how we would be able to withstand another 4 years of the constant, just the constant stress of the attacks, the harm to not only Palestinian communities, but communities around the globe and inside the United States. Trump has attacked everyone from the disabled to transgendered people, to black communities, to Hispanic communities. It's just, you know, it's anyone who doesn't fit the mold of, you know, that white, you know, able-bodied cisgendered man. It was under attack under the Trump regime, which is, you know, the definition of white supremacy. So no, that's very welcome. You know, what does it mean for Palestine? I think we knew going in that the Biden-Harris administration would be no friend to Palestine. But they are, you know, they are a target. They are a target that can be moved in a way that Trump could not be moved. In that, you know, within the Democratic Party, we have a very, very robust debate about progressive issues, not only Palestine, but about climate change, about militarism writ large, and about, you know, healthcare and so many other issues. And the Biden administration is way behind on all of those things. You know, the party supporters, the people that voted Biden into office, are going to be demanding that he move left. And we have the members of the squad grew in this election. The number of House seats for the Democrats did get reduced, and they didn't capture the Senate. But the number of people who are going to be pushing left on issues is increasing. So, you know, Biden may think that he's going to be able to come in and just restore bipartisan support for Israel, but he's going to be challenged. And so that is exciting.
You just mentioned the fact that even though it's been clear that the Biden-Harris administration is not going to be an automatic friend of Palestine, at the same time, there is more scope for pushing them than there has been in the last 4 years of a Trump administration. So just to drill down into that a little more, I mean, the Trump administration poured considerable resources into making life difficult for the Palestine movement in the United States, from attempting to redefine anti-Semitism in order to expose Palestinian rights advocates to civil rights lawsuits, to shutting down the Palestine Liberation Organization office in Washington, D.C. Do you think the Biden administration will try to roll back some of these legal and diplomatic assaults? And do grassroots organizers have a role to play in stepping up the pressure to do so?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Biden administration will do some very superficial rollbacks. Particularly, I think the PLO office probably will come back to DC because the PA has already signaled that they have resumed security coordination with Israel in an attempt to be in the good graces of the Biden administration. there will be, you know, some conditions put on them, but I do believe that that office will reopen. And whether that's a positive or not, you know, that's another conversation. And I do think that Biden will restore funding to UNRWA in some amount, just to, if nothing else, to contain the growing crisis in Gaza. Containment is not what Palestinians, of course, are asking for, but I think that that is a goal of both Israel and the U.S. to make sure that that situation remains quiet. But as far as rolling back, you know, even Pompeo's decision on BDS as being equivalent to anti-Semitism, to, you know, any of the other issues that that Trump has instead, you know, the annexation of the Golan Heights or the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, none of that is going to be reversed. Biden has said that he would not move the embassy back. And so, you know, we're starting at less than and at ground zero. We're way in the negatives at this point. So yes, it's absolutely imperative that we push back on all these policies. You know, I think what I mentioned earlier, the facade of the peace process really poses the biggest threat to the Palestine movement. I think it was very clear under Trump where Palestinians stood vis-a-vis Israel. The lines were drawn very clearly that there was a very ideological line between authoritarian regimes in the world, like the Trump regime, like the Netanyahu regime. And then there were people around the globe that were rising up against those oppressive figures. And Palestinians were part of that global struggle for justice. And my fear is that now we're entering a period where Biden will, you know, complicate that story, and that, you know, people will not really know what to think about where the Palestinians fit in anymore, because Biden will make nice. He'll hide his conflicts with Israel from public light, and we'll really try to push forward this idea that it's the Palestinians that are hindering progress on negotiations or return to negotiations. And this is going to impact the way that we do grassroots organizing. We have to be able to disrupt the idea that negotiations have ever been helpful to Palestinians. And that's, you know, not an easy sell to liberals, to believe that all you have to do is talk through your differences and you get to a better outcome. So I think we really have to be able to tell a story about how U.S. policies have harmed Palestinians from day one, how our fragmentation that is established by Israeli and U.S. policy, fragmentation of the Palestinian people, has made negotiations impossible. Has made only one entity, you know, so the sort of the legitimate party to be at the negotiating table, a party that, you know, is not democratically elected and represents interests that don't represent the majority of Palestinians. I think all of these things are going to be very challenging for us going forward.
I want to pull a little more on a couple of threads from your last answer. You mentioned on the one hand this fragmentation, a level of fragmentation in this progressive agenda that that Palestine rights advocates are trying to push forward in the United States. And on the other hand, this maybe counterintuitive complication that might be brought about by having a democratic president in power. One of Adala Justice Project's key missions is to integrate Palestine into the broader progressive agenda in the United States. So do you think a democratic administration will make this goal harder or easier to achieve?
You know, I think that we have a better target. We always, you know, we push, we didn't endorse a candidate, but we certainly were hoping for a democratic president because that makes our job of pushing things further to our understanding of the world a little bit easier. So, you know, we definitely think it's going to be an easier time. It's not going to be a cakewalk by any means. But like I said, we're not going to be reacting all the time. I think it gives us a moment to be more strategic, to widen our coalitions. I think because Biden has so behind on other progressive issues, we have a moment where we can say to progressive organizers who do work on fighting against climate change, on groups that are working on racial justice, groups that are working on healthcare for all, they will understand that Palestine is part of that progressive agenda because they also will be targeting Biden. So we're going to find ways to come into coalition together. One example is that because of the win of Jamal Bowman in New York as a representative there against Elliot Engel, the position of the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee is open. Elliot Engel had that position for the last year. Elliot Engel is a military hawk, is a very staunch supporter of Israeli policies. And so his defeat, provides a really opportune vacancy in the leadership of the Democratic leadership of the House. So that position, the second in line is Representative Brad Sherman of California, who's really a carbon copy of Elliot Engel's, voted for the war in Iraq, voted against troops in Afghanistan to come home, and has always supported Israel very staunchly. He was one of the Dems that went to the Netanyahu speech in the joint session in Congress back in 2015. The fact that he's even being challenged, I think, is a win for the Palestine movement. He's being challenged by Gregory Meeks of New York, who is, a member of the Black Congressional Caucus and is seen as a more progressive member. Progressive groups looked at his record. He gets a lot of money from PACs, including Israeli PACs, pro-Israel PACs, has had really terrible policies in Latin America. Supported the Uribe regime against Afro-Colombians and other Colombian grassroots organizers. Progressive orgs looked at that candidate and said, no, this is not a good alternative. And they recruited Joaquin Castro of Texas to run for the seat. And Castro, while not, sort of a radical, he hasn't signed on to any legislation like Betty McCollum's legislation to hold Israel accountable. He is staking out a leftist position on militarism. And he's, put himself out there by saying Palestinians have not been allowed to speak on issues related to policies that impact their lives. And he signed on most recently to a letter that Representative Mark Pocan led on, condemning destruction of West Bank Village on Election Day, U.S. Election Day, and demanding 41 representatives demanding to know if U.S. Equipment was used in the destruction of those homes. So Castro is, pulling this conversation left. And, we are excited about the prospects of him, winning. What we hear is that, maybe a few weeks ago, that race looked like a lost cause for Castro, but it looks like it's closer than what some people think, largely because, he's gaining traction among people who think that there has to be more Hispanic leadership in the Biden administration. So we shall see, but his, he's going to be another target. I don't think that he's going to be our friend from day one, but because he's set himself up to these commitments, I think that we have an opportunity to hold him accountable to those commitments.
So looking to the future, and not just in this immediate post-Trump moment where everything still feels very up in the air and up for grabs and uncertain, but also longer term, what are the hopes and goals of Adala Justice Projects and the wider Palestine movement in the United States? And what are you seeking to accomplish in terms of continuing to build a movement with other progressive groups?
Yeah, it's a great question, Natasha. I mean, I think we're beginning to breathe and think now about what's possible. I think always the mission in the end is to make a very clear case for Palestine as a progressive issue. If people want to fund all of the progressive issues in the US that are so urgent, like healthcare, like funding for the Green New Deal, like minimum wage increases for people, student debt relief, all these things, we have to address our military spending. We have to think about why more than 50% of the US discretionary spending at the federal level goes to the military, and why in US cities, between 30 and 50% of our budgets go to policing. We have to realign our priorities with our budgets. And I think that, because that is the trend and that is what people are demanding, even in, red states like Florida that voted to increase the minimum wage to $15 this last election, I think we're going to have an easier time in making those connections. And so that's really where my head is, in making sure that anyone who's advocating for all of those important human imperatives in the U.S. knows that it can't stop at our own borders. It has to, we have to think about the U.S.'s footprint everywhere and bring those dollars home and just be, a different kind of force in the world.
Well, that's a very hopeful note to end on, combined with some steely resolve, which I think is very apposite for this moment. So, Sandra Tamari, thank you very much for being on the 972 podcast.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by Natasha Roth-Roland and edited by me, Henrya Chukar.
This poem will not end apartheid. My words, no matter how beautiful, clever, or carefully strung together, will not end the occupation, allow the refugees to return, or create equality within Israeli society. The status quo is a fantasy, telling us it's okay to sit on our hands called political art propaganda, rather than those who politicize our lives, propagandists. Every American Brit should ask themselves this question: why are bombs and white phosphorus getting dropped on open-air prisons with money that should be going to pay for your medical expenses? And dear academics and leftists, I appreciate your books on Israeli massacres, but you refuse to take the bullets out of IDF guns with your stances. The problem is not just the occupation or putting a better face on Zionism, because 750,000 Palestinians were displaced before those settlements were constructed, half of them before Israel was created. We don't need another book explaining the situation. We need a lesson plan to stop the next bomb from dropping. Silence is complicity. Intellectual masturbation tells us to theorize on the power of art, while farmers are kicked off land, children are stoned on the way to school, people are caged and beaten and split from loved ones, bombed and broken in open-air prisons, bought and paid for with our tax dollars. We are part of the problem. That's not theoretical. I don't want to hug a segregationist, wave to you at a separate water fountain, or appeal to you from the back of the bus. A day will come, I swear to you all, when Zionists cower in embarrassment, deny involvement like those who profited off of Stephen Biko and Bobby Sands' lifeless body. So yes, I'm going to boycott all Israeli products and go to the root of the conflict, because settlements are just the branches of the Zionist program. Every 729 cultural institution and dialogue farce, from Sabra to Ahava, Max Brenner to Aroma, Level of Vive and Motorola, signing a 2-year contract, stacks up little to 63 years of continued ethnic cleansing. Finally, to all you artists building bridges between apartheid and normalization, you serve an agenda which rebrands colonialism as enlightened liberalism. Concerts, ballets, and raves in Israel's Sun City, a haven and party stop for pink washers who callously ignore Palestinian LGBT groups fighting against all systems of oppression. Palestinian civil society has spoken. Don't cross this picket line or cash in that paycheck signed apartheid. Put down stolen beauty, cancel that gig, and join the rest of us on the right side of history.
Yeah.
اعترف اي كورنان حاجات اصلاحات ويزي كمات اعترف اي كورنان حاجات اصلاحات ويزي كمات كشف اثار المومياوات ومياوات هات الحوادث الاحادث في البلاد يشتغل في الممنوعات قوم يا واد هات الحوادث الاحادث في البلاد النقود عجت لجوت عصبر وداب في الملاحات النبي سخت العيال نصبح مال زي البلد وان النادية باريزة وقعت وان فاطمة شار رجعت وان شكري شرك هو شري وان جوعك قط بري ان شرك هو شري وان جوعك قط بري بس بعد التعري يديك برد الحاجات بحلفة بر العمر مر وما انتهتش المسألة الاستراح واللي براح لبس داير عالولا حلفة بر العمر مر وما انتهتش المسألة الاستراح واللي براح لبس داير عالولا وسين وجين مش طال جين بيجري في بلاد الخلا سين وجين مش طال جين بيجري في بلاد الخلا مقلت صوت تبقى بنموت وما انتهتش المسألة مقلت صوت تبقى بنموت وما انتهتش المسألة ما انتهتش المسألة ما انتهتش المسألة يا حلفة بر العمر فات ولسه بقرب في الحاجات الصحات ويزي كمان مش بقى زري المومياوات
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Hey everybody, Derek Sege here. So we won't be hosting our families for the holidays this year, but let's look on the bright side. Got an aunt with some zany theories? Just mute her on the family video calls. A hippie cousin that bring new wave sludge to Réveillon? Not this year. To protect your family's health and safety, it's important you stay home and enjoy the peace and quiet.
Put your pants on, time to shovel the driveway!
Right away, hon. Safe holidays. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
To slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why, once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the gouvernement.